The views and opinions expressed by the guests of the Inspira podcast do not necessarily represent the official policy or position of any agency of the United States government or any organization, public or private.
One, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to the Inspira podcast, hosted by your girl, me, Erica Mueller Chen. I'm an international development specialist with over a decade of experience leveraging the amazing power of sport to promote peace and positive social impact. My career has allowed me to live in Europe, Southern Africa, and Latin America. In 2022, I accepted an offer for my dream job in sports diplomacy. And I also became an employee family member to a U.S. diplomat, aka an EFM. This podcast is all about inspiration and career advice. Each episode, I'll interview an inspirational global changemaker working in sport for development, social impact, or the diplomatic service. This series is perfect if you have interest in breaking into one of these sectors. Or you've already landed that dream role and are keen to learn from thought leaders. Enjoy today's episode and stay inspired.
One promising female weightlifter, she must have been 15, never returned to school after summer holidays. We learned from the teachers that she had actually gotten married. So that struck me personally very hard. And I just thought that I cannot be working in this space without paying attention to the local context and realities.
Welcome, friends. Today's special guest is Suhail F. Tandon. Suhail is the founder of Pro Sport Development, an award-winning social enterprise dedicated to utilizing sport for the holistic development of young people. Suhail believes in the power of sport in catalyzing social transformation, and he has led the conceptualization and initiation of several sport and development projects across India. He attributes developing a passion for sport while completing his schooling from the world-renowned Woodstock School in Mussoorie, India. Welcome, Suhail. How are you, and where are you calling us from today?
Thanks, Erica. Thanks for that kind introduction. I'm calling from New Delhi in India.
Wonderful. Well, I'm really thrilled to have you on the podcast. And I was so excited to actually meet you in person a few months ago when we were both in the UK. So that's such a privilege, especially in this international community. It can be so tricky to actually meet people in person. And I'm glad we're here today in our virtual recording. Suhail, one thing I like to do before we get into the questions is just mention why the guest inspires me, because I've called this podcast Inspira. And from what I understand about your background and the work you're doing now, what I really love and get excited about is that you're providing local solutions to communities in India while you've also amassed international partnerships and support, which I would imagine helps with some sustainability and connections and learning. And so I'm really looking forward to better understanding how you've struck that really important and tricky balance of local and global, and just learning more about what you're up to with Pro Sport Development.
Thank you.
So maybe for starters, I can ask you to provide us with a brief overview of your sports career journey and how or why you entered the sport for development space.
So I've been a sports nut. I've played watch sport growing up. After my school, I did a very usual undergrad for many Indians. I went into a science, undergrad, doing actually math and economics, not engineering, which is very common for Indians to do, but math and economics, not knowing what I really wanted to do. And then I actually stumbled upon a family friend who told me that there is actually, you can make a career in sport. There are courses you can do. There's a whole industry globally. And that really excited me. So I ended up doing my sports management master's in the UK. And it was in the UK while studying at Loughborough University that I started thinking of working at the grassroots in India, at the intersection of sport and working with young people. And I took all the learnings from my time at Loughborough back to India, seeking opportunities working in grassroots sport. The idea was, and I still believe this, there's plenty of sporting talent in India, but most of the sporting talent is concentrated among populations that have the talent but not the means to pursue it. So that was the idea I went back with. As any young graduate, I started looking for jobs in India. Unfortunately, this was 12 years back. There wasn't much happening in the space of grassroots sports. There was a lot happening in sports sponsorship, broadcasting, marketing, but that just didn't interest me. So foolishly or bravely, I jumped into this. starting something of my own. The idea was to work with young people, marginalized young people, especially from rural areas, who had the sporting talent, but not the means to pursue it. But working in our first project in rural India on the eastern coast with indigenous young people, I came to realize that sport was having a much larger impact on these young people, especially girls, and sort of I experienced the true power of sport, and that also helped me reflect back on my own journey on how sport had been so impactful for me, for my learning, for my personal development, because I had played sport in school and all throughout university and had a very close affinity to it. So that's sort of how I stumbled into the world of sport for development.
Wow, that's really special. And just knowing that you had this passion for sport and you were maybe following what other people wanted you to academically, but then you're able to find that program in the UK, which is also world renowned in terms of sports education. And then introducing this concept to a community in India and just saying that it was bigger than what you could have ever anticipated. And so I'd love to know kind of about those early years with pro sport development and maybe what your original intention was and if that has changed over the years and what the goals are today.
When I first started pro sport development, it was definitely geared towards equipping young people with the resources, the support that they could develop their sporting ability. And this was working with marginalized, underserved young people from rural India. The project had a lot of milestones that we managed to achieve in a short span of 2 years. About 25 athletes went on to national sporting competitions and won medals there. Our main sports were weightlifting, athletics, volleyball. So that was a great achievement. But one incident that still stuck with me while I was there, I was also based out of rural India for a couple of years. One promising female weightlifter, she must have been 15, never returned to school after summer holidays. So when we inquired when she was coming back, we learned from the teachers that she'd actually gotten married. So that struck me personally very hard, and I just thought that I cannot be working in this space without paying attention to the local context and realities. And that's when sort of the shift happened to a more sport for development approach and outlook for pro sport development. So after the first 2.5 years of working in that project, we decided to pivot into what is our current objective and vision, is basically to use sport and physical activity as a tool for the overall and holistic development of young people in order for them to lead better lives, have better skills, and go ahead in education and in their careers, whether that is a sporting career or most likely, beyond sport. So that's sort of the one incident that really has stuck with me. And that sort of, made us shift our objectives and goals.
With that shift, Suhail, I'm really curious if that impacted the ease of your work, because I would imagine that if you're promoting talent development, you might garner a lot of excitement from sponsors or the community or even parents saying, oh, like, you're going to allow this person to become really talented at sport. And then when you shifted to social, even though you and I can argue all day that that's much more important, sometimes there's not as much support with that priority. And so was that your experience, or kind of what doors maybe opened from that shift? And were there any doors that you felt like were kind of closing once you made that shift?
I don't think any doors had closed. I think our initial work, like you said, was exciting, was tangible. And so it got us a lot of attention. And because we'd done well in that project, it got our name out there. So that helped. But it was challenging. I knew sport. Our team at that point knew sport. But then we had to link it to these social outcomes, which is obviously, as you know, much harder. So there were many challenges internally looking at it. We had to think about what approaches we're going to take. How is it going to be different to our previous programming? How are we going to really link sport and development outcomes? How are we going to train our team for that? So there were all those considerations. Externally also, it was challenging. Sport was just coming into sort of the was being highlighted rather in the national consciousness. A lot of young people were getting attracted to it. A lot of parents were becoming more, they were sort of thinking about their young people getting into sport or their children getting into sport. But there was an initial pushback. So when we went to schools, for example, their first question was, where are the kids going to go play? Are they going to play at state, national, beyond that? So we had to say that actually the program is using sport as a tool and really helping them develop personally and improving their lives as individuals rather than their sporting potential. At that point, we also took the decision to implement programs in mixed gender groups because we thought we. Obviously, given my experience before, I wanted to focus on gender as a sort of central objective of our programming. So we wanted to do mixed gender programming and do it based in schools and basically utilize the existing physical education or games period. So there was some pushback from parents. Especially parents of girls asking, why are girls and boys playing together? Can't they play separately? So we had to find ways of, dealing with that. The second thing from parents was many of the young people we work with are first generation learners in their families. So they are the first ones going to school. Now, parents were questioning why are we sending our kids to school for them to play sport? They should be in classroom studying. So again, there had to be, we had to work on that. So what we thought we just need to work with the young people and sort of coordinate with the schools. It was a lot more than that. And it was, we spent a lot of time with the school authorities, teachers, parents, community members, explaining what we were doing, and that sort of continues till today. So there was that shift as well that needed to be made. And lastly, from a from a sort of resource mobilization partnerships perspective, it was different. We had to just pivot to find partners who aligned with what we were doing. So it took a while to obviously do that. And I'm not saying that we've got it all figured out, but it did take a while to sort of find our footing there.
Quick break here with a special message from your host. This episode is being released in celebration of the United Nations recognized International Day of Sport for Development and Peace, which takes place annually on April 6th. Each year, champions of the sport for development sector use this day to raise awareness of the incredible work that individuals and organizations are leading across the globe to leverage the potential power of sport and play to drive tangible impact and positive social change. I hope that listeners, whether an enthusiast, a skeptic, or a novice in this space, that you find the conversations I facilitate on the Inspira podcast to be informative and inspirational. If you enjoy this podcast, you would be a rock star if you went ahead and gave it a 5-star review with a complimentary written sentence or two on Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast platform. Enjoy listening and happy April 6th, everybody.
I'd love to know more about how you went about developing the curriculums that you're using today, or what you had mentioned about that, recognizing that early need to link the sport activities or the physical activities to developmental outcome goals. How did you and your team go about doing that?
I think reflecting on your question, the first couple of years of experience that we have working on the ground was very critical to this. We had obviously started thinking about at that point and started running programs on the ground. So that was a great experience. It helped us understand the context we were working in, what would work, what would not work, how to engage young people meaningfully. And it also showed us in the first 2 years what impact sports programming was having. So I think we combined all of that and sort of a collective team effort to get something down in writing, which could be a useful resource for our team then and for future to use. So again, our curriculum and the different programs we work with, the curriculum, so that have gone through different iterations and they continue evolving according to the needs as well of the young people, according to the realities. Things such as COVID have been a big disruptor. So I think it's always going to be a work in progress. But I think that initial learning was very key. And what we thought was, we actually wanted to do a lot of the learning on the ground. So we've spent a lot of time linking a lot of the activities to learnings and actually, having discussions around it, collectively learning on the play field. Again, from our experiences, we realized that a lot of these young people were already having the English, math, other classes in classrooms. They were stuck in classrooms for 6-7 hours a day. They wanted to get out. They wanted to, experience something different, something creative, something where they could actually express themselves. And so that's sort of the things we worked on. So I think it would have been different if you made a curriculum and then went on the ground to implement it. I think we would have had to come back and do a lot of reworking on it. So yeah. I think it was good that it happened the other way around.
And my follow-up question to that, based off of what you just said, is how did you measure impact? And was that a big priority for you? Because oftentimes I speak to people or organizations who discuss the importance of having your measurement plan ready as early as possible, but that's pretty contradictory to holistic development and meeting the community's needs as the needs evolve. So, what was that monitoring impact piece like, and how much time you put into that throughout your experience?
I think it went side by side, but I think it's something that's evolved as well. It's not like we had it all figured out on day one. I think we also wanted to implement on the ground, see what the response is, get feedback, and the monitoring and evaluation process evolved from there. And it's still evolving. So again, we haven't, we don't have it all figured out, rather. And I think it's important to keep learning as you go again. You know, what we are trying to measure is very difficult to measure, especially in short periods of time where we are expected to drive change and have impact. So I think one thing we've been clear on is we have sort of based on the timelines that we get projects for, we devise evaluation systems that are in line with that and not expecting too much out of our systems as well. These are learning processes that take time. We've seen now that any young person will benefit from the program and show results between 3 to 5 years of being part of the program. And that's a long time frame. So I think we've done a mix of quantitative, qualitative measurements. We've experimented, we've learned from that, we've learned from others what they've been doing, picked out what's been relevant to us. And I think, we've sort of evolved with how the program, the curriculum has evolved, and how the context has evolved. So again, I don't think we have it all figured out, but we're trying to sort of also see what's relevant. And I think one thing we tend to forget is I think we need to have a participatory approach where we involve different stakeholders. Just because a donor wants to see numbers, it that might not be relevant to actually the young people and their families. Like if I go and tell a young person, yeah, actually your confidence as a group increased by 30%, it is meaningless to them. I'd rather tell them a story, through a video or a written article that they can read, which they will sort of understand better. So I think we try sort of different mediums as well to monitor, evaluate, document our work and our impact. And so again, it's something that's evolving, and we are learning continuously. So.
Yeah, that's really interesting what you just mentioned. It makes me think about the nuances and challenges of stakeholder management or diverse communications across groups, because it sounds like you and your team probably have to speak with some different lingo and some different terms to different groups, right? You just said that the parents and the participants are going to be more keen on certain information. And of course, other partners or funders or people more interested in data are going to want the hard numbers. And so that leads me to think a little bit more about this idea of international partnerships, this idea of collaboration, which I understand you've done, in my opinion, very well. And I'm wondering what you think has allowed you or your team to really tap into international partners or organizations?
Good question. I think given my education abroad, I think I had some linkages abroad that I could sort of look into as part of my work, which definitely helped. I think other than that, right from the beginning, we were very keen to work in collaboration with individuals and organizations. We didn't feel like we could do everything, A, and we always felt like doing things with others would make outcomes better, but also the learning process more meaningful. So right from the beginning, we had a lot of volunteers coming from abroad to help out. And this was key in the beginning to set up our programs. You know, they could, for example, they brought some of their skill sets which were useful for us, for example, designing a curriculum. But then we had local staff who had the context and understood, you know, the local area dynamics. So that blend was good. And I think so that sort of keenness to collaborate was always there. Started with me personally having that interest, and now, you know, our organization, our team members sharing that interest as well. And I think we were just keen to sort of showcase our work globally as well. Not in terms of, you know, showing off what we did, but sharing what we had done as sort of we moved into the sport for development sector. We realized it's actually global. There's lots of amazing projects happening across the world. So why not connect with them, share what we're doing, learn from them, understand what their experience has been. And so I think somewhere just sort of our ability to network more globally. Sometimes it's hard to look beyond your local context or look beyond your own country. But we stuck our head out there and sort of tried to see what you know we could learn, and sort of it paid off. People and organizations looked at our work, valued our work, valued the experience that we had built, and then wanted to sort of connect with us. It started with work in India, either to support our work or, you know, to work in collaboration on certain projects. And more recently, now we have been working on more international projects that actually might not concern India, which has been really great to be involved in the global sector. So that's sort of how it came about. I think just having the mindset of working or sort of being visible more globally sort of led to all of this, more from the intention of, telling others about our work and learning from others about theirs.
And I just want to thank you for being so open with all of your answers. I know I'm throwing a lot of questions about you regarding pro sport development. And my hope is that not only this can be a platform for you to share more about your work, but also a learning opportunity for others, because I have found that sometimes these stories are so hidden, these founders' journeys, or especially organizations like yours, where I feel like it has become quite sophisticated in its own right and quite well connected. I'm always curious how and why, and it's not always the case where I can ask somebody to really open up about those things. So I really do appreciate that. And Suhail, it also strikes me from hearing you speak just how much your own humility and learning attitude and just being transparent with things, recognizing, okay, this might not work. How can we change this? Or we don't know it all today. How can we find out how to teach ourselves or learn from what others have already done, so we're not reinventing things? And in that regard, I'm wondering, in reflecting, when you first started this journey, are there certain skills or knowledges that you think you had at the beginning? And maybe what skills and knowledges have you been able to personally or professionally develop over these past years that you think have helped you in this journey?
I think in terms of the skills and knowledge that I came with, it was a very bookish knowledge, something that you would, you know, study in your degrees. But I think the knowledge that helped the most was I did a lot of cricket coaching. I worked with young people through that. All that sort of helped me understand what young people wanted through sport, how we could work with them, And just I personally saw university as a space to meet diverse people and learn about their journeys, learn about what they think, especially when I did my sport degree, what they thought of sport, how they viewed sport. And I think that's all of those things is what I got in the beginning. Just having a diverse perspective on how to do things. Everything else I learned. You can learn. I sort of learned the development lingo and the parlance that comes in the development sector. You learn it. You know, I think if you have the right intention and the passion, you can learn that. I don't think we ever with the thought that we knew everything and we're going to teach everyone what we know. That wasn't the case at all. I think we were just trying to help others and we were just seeing how we could do that best. So I think those were some of the things we came with. And having the right team, having other people who support this kind of way of working is very critical. There is a lot of information out there. You can acquire knowledge through different mediums now. So it's just sort of knowing what you require. And that's what we were allowed as an organization in the beginning to see how we could go about doing this in the best way possible. Not everyone gets that chance. And we were very supportive in the journey. And that helped us realize what we needed. For example, when we first went in, we were focused on operations implementing sports programming. And then we learned, you know, that we need to monitor and evaluate our programs. We need to document it. We need to advocate for it. We need to build partnerships. We need to do many more things. And that's how we learned. And I think, I mean, I was quite young when I started this journey. So it was a steep learning curve, but it was great thinking about it now. Many of the things I could not even learn, even if I did 5 degrees. They're such practical things. And learning from others, you know, it's from their experiences. So I think just having an open mind, also you do learn a lot of things in degrees, but how you can contextualize that and use it for a local community or a group of individuals' benefit is something that I think you need to keep at the forefront.
One thing we haven't touched on yet is funding and funding streams. And I'm curious, Suhail, because I understand that Pro Sport Development, the organization, identifies as a social enterprise. Could you describe what that means to you in the organization and anything you feel comfortable sharing in terms of how you've been able to create funding streams?
Sure. We describe ourselves as a social enterprise. By that, we mean some of our funding is acquired through traditional funding routes, such as individual donations, grant funding, institutional funding from institutional donors. We haven't been very successful with government funding, but those are the sort of traditional streams of funding that we pursue. But we also raise resources by providing services, mostly technical services, such as strategy development, monitoring and evaluation, research, advocacy and communications, focused in the sport for development field. And those resources raised through these technical services are then cross-subsidized for our work with young children. So we operate as a nonprofit entity. So any additional funds are put back into our work with young people, focusing on working with marginalized sections. So that was the idea. Again, it sort of happened organically. We started with a very traditional approach to fundraising. And then when we switched to focusing our organization on sport for development outcomes, we found it quite challenging to raise resources. In the meantime, what happened, because of our initial work, many organizations got in touch with us saying, you have done this. Can you help us with this? I saw that you have done this really well, or I saw this report. Can you help us with this? And we thought that, this could be a good avenue to raise some resources to cross-subsidize our work. And the biggest sort of example of this working was in COVID, because most of our institutional funding, grant funding, was either on hold or had, sort of dried up at that point of time. And so, especially the 1 year since COVID broke out in India, which was March 2020, especially that 1 year, I think it was critical that we were set up in that way. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have survived as an organization. That area of our work really helped us stay afloat and cross-subsidize the work we did with young people during that period. For example, we worked with young people through digital mediums, so we had to reconfigure our programming. And actually, there was no funds for it. We got funds for providing COVID kits and masks and et cetera, but not for that programming. So that helped us cross-subsidize. And even though we were a small team of about 10 to 12 then, we didn't have to let go of anyone, which is quite something given the situation. So I think that was the biggest test of this model, and I think it just helped me personally and us as an organization really believe in it, and that it could actually be more sustainable for us to operate in this way and also help us scale in the future.
Today, how old is Pro Sport Development? How many staff members do you have? And ballpark estimation, how many people are you reaching on average and how many locations?
Really pleased to say that this is our 10th year. In September this year, we'll be celebrating our 10th anniversary. So, really looking forward to that. In terms of our staff, we're almost close to 20 people now.
Wow.
And we've seen a lot of growth in the last year. In terms of young people, since its inception, we've reached out to more than 12,000 young people,
Wow.
half being girls. This past year, we have actually reached out to more young people in a year than we have since inception. So we're working with more than 800 young people across 8 schools. We've worked across geographies in India, across in 16 states, but our focus work in the last 10 years has been in a state called Odisha, which is on the eastern coast of India, which is historically been one of the most marginalized states, and that's where we also have a team based out of.
And if I'm a parent, so Heal, what about the qualitative impact? What are some of those stories or exciting moments of impact where you or your team have witnessed that really positive role sport can have on an individual or on a group?
The most impact we've seen from a qualitative lens has been on the young girls that we've worked with. A couple of years back, we started a peer leader program. So young people who had been part of our programming for a while, we selected as peer leaders who we would give additional mentoring, leadership, and a small scholarship to pursue their higher education. And we had a great partner, Kickoff Solutions, who came on board. And it was just fantastic to see these six young women who are part of our program basically grow further, and the kind of leadership they took on, the kind of self-confidence, self-belief in them, and sort of a career-wise, big aspirations. Some want to be doctors, some want to join the army, which was fantastic to see. Two incidents which sort of show the impact. One was we worked in a school which catered to a slum area which had a large Muslim population. So there were girls who used to come in head scarves and to school, and they were part of our program. So part of our program, we give shorts and t-shirts to all the participants, but we'll never force them to wear it if they're not comfortable. So many girls will wear the t-shirt on top of their school dress or whatever they are comfortable with. And when I initially went to the school, I visited it to see a session, and the girls were participating in their headscarves. And it was great to see. After about 8 months, when I went to the same school, and I saw that all the children were in shorts and t-shirts. So I was first alarmed. I said, "Have those girls dropped out?" So I asked my team, and they were like, "No, they just pointed at them. They're right here." So they were all wearing shorts and t-shirts. Very small thing, but in the sort of rigid spaces and conservative communities where these young people come from, I think that was itself a big achievement. So that was one incident that really sticks with me. Another incident is in actually during COVID, when we started working with young people online, very new for us, very new for them. An organization based in the US actually got in touch, and they also used to work with young people, and they wanted to do a virtual exchange. So just getting a group of young people from our end, from their end, to share cultural cultural exchanges, what it's like, where they live, etc., etc. We thought it was a brilliant idea. And so we went about selecting young people, and a lot of discussion happened. We had two translators from our side because they had to be translations from Uriya to Hindi and then Hindi to English. And there was all this preparation that went in. And then when I was part of the call, and when the interaction happened, none of our young people spoke in any language other than in English. And I myself was amazed the fluency which they spoke, not just the fluency, the confidence. They'd never met these other young people. And from my experience of living in North America, I've found young people in North America to be very outgoing, very confident. And in that call, I felt that our young people were more confident than them. So that was just amazing to see. And it sort of, even for me, it just sort of showed me the impact our program was having on these young people, and sort of that we were doing something right. So I think that was really heartening to see.
Those are really incredible impacts. So thank you for sharing those, Sahil. And now, kind of thinking about the sector, or thinking about this greater movement of sport for social impact, sport for development and peace, I'm curious what opportunities you feel exist for young professionals hoping to work in the sector, whether that's inside of India or out of India.
I think it's a very exciting time to join the sector, especially as a young professional. COVID was very harsh, but I think a silver lining, if I may say, of COVID is a lot of attention is now being put on healthy lifestyles, linking sport and physical activity with sort of more holistic development. Social impact of sport. Just in our programs, parents are so keen to enroll young people in sports programs. The same parents who were wary of their children playing sport in school. So I think there's a great opportunity to join the sector. I think it's rebounding from COVID. What the sector lacks, to be honest, is young professionals who have good skills to come and work with us. That is something missing in the sector because it's such a niche sector. People fall through the cracks and don't actually join the sector. They'll either join the sports industry or the development sector. So I think yes, jobs are limited. It's a small sector, but we need people. We need people to come and work with us. And we are open to different types of engagement. So I think that's something to keep in mind. I think I've been doing this for 10 years and sort of I'm in it for the long haul. And I feel that, you know, in the next 10 years, we're going to see a massive growth in this sector. I think we're just sort of at a stage where things are picking up. And I think sport, or rather elite and professional sport in its current form, seem to me as unsustainable as they are. I think something needs to change. I think the sort of the true essence of sport, with which, you know, we all start playing, and the sort of benefits of sport are being recognized. So it's only a matter of time where, you know, this sector will grow and grow exponentially. So I think it's a great time to invest. It's a sector where, you know, we don't ask, oh, have you done a master's in sport for development? You can be from any background. So the advantage is, even if you work here for 1 or 2 years, want to get some experience, and you feel like this is not for you, you can easily transition into another role in another sector. I think for young people looking at the sector, I would say take that leap of faith and take that risk. It might pay off.
Now that we know more about our guest's career journey, the rest of our conversation will allow us to have some fun and get to know our guest on a personal level through some rapid-fire questions. We'll then start to wrap up with pointed questions focused on advice and how our listeners can transform interest into action. Enjoy the rest of the conversation. What's your favorite sport?
Cricket. Diehard cricket fan. Have been since I was young. Still continue playing it. I play all sports, but cricket is something. I could watch cricket. I could watch the whole 5-day game.
I was so going to say, that's a big commitment. It's not like, okay, you need a few hours. You need a whole week.
I don't get the time to do it, but you know, I would if I did.
Do you have a favorite sports team?
Good question. I don't have a favorite sports team, but I always root for the underdog.
Mm, I like that.
In any sport. Mm-hmm. Just something that that draws me to them.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite athlete?
So if you asked me this question 10 years back, it would have been a cricketer. I could, you know, tell you three on the the top of my head. But now I think someone who is a bit more inspirational beyond sport. Basically, pathbreakers, those who sort of make us see beyond sport. I mean, some international icons like Naomi Osaka, you know, like Colin Kaepernick, like Duti Chand in India, who's a sprinter. And like they have sort of been pathbreakers, but beyond their sporting journey, which I find quite inspiring.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, do you have any hobbies outside of sport? I know this whole conversation has focused heavily on sport.
I do like watching some TV shows and movies, but more than anything, I'm probably a foodie. So I love trying different types of food. I love going to different restaurants. I am a foodie. Mm.
Do you have a favorite dish?
Ooh, that's a hard question. So comfort food-wise, it has to be rice and dal. Dal is a type of lentil you make in India. That's very comfort food for me. But I do like Mexican food, and you don't get it so much in India. So that's maybe why I like it so much more.
And what's your spice tolerance? I mean, compared to, I guess, people who don't live in India, because I've learned from living in Mexico that if we say, oh, mild spicy, it's not my mild. It's very hot spicy. So,
Yeah.
can you handle that Mexican or Indian food very spicy?
I can actually, but certain type of spice. I can't handle green chilies, but I can handle any type of hot dish like a hot curry, but just raw green chilies can't do it. But otherwise, it's quite
Good to know your
high.
limit. It's a safety thing. Good to know.
Exactly.
Well, Sohail, you've already given some really nice advice, some really nice observations of the sector, and recommendations for what people can be thinking about if they're a young person interested in the sector. Is there anything else you would say to somebody who comes to you and says, I really want to make a career in sport for development? What advice might you give them?
The first advice, especially if you want to get into this sector, is it's very cliched, but it's networking. Now, many people find it intimidating, but it's not, it shouldn't be. I think the sector is small. People are very approachable. I mean, this is telling you sitting on the other side, people are very approachable. And at most, you won't get a response. But if you don't try, you don't know. That's why I tell people in India, IT industry in India is, very well defined, runs, like clockwork. Everything is sort of, is sort of figured out. The sport for development is completely the opposite. We don't have everything figured out. Nothing, not all opportunities go on our websites. So just have a conversation. Reach out to people. They will, get back to you. LinkedIn has become a powerful tool to do that. So look at that. But just don't be afraid to reach out. That's one thing. And the second is, again, like I mentioned this before, you can be from any background, but I think if your interests lie in at the intersection of sport and development, then give it a try. Many people say to me, I don't have the right background. I don't have the skills. I think, again, sitting from the on the other side, what I'm thinking, when people collaborate with us, we work together, is, are they passionate enough? Do they have the drive? Do they want to do this? Do they want to learn? Everything else, is sort of teachable. So I think, yeah, I don't think you need any specific kind of skills or background to enter the sector. Obviously, once you're in the sector, you can specialize. But to enter the sector, just keep an open mind, and that's all you need, and a passion for sport and development.
What is one thing that someone should think about before starting their own sport for development initiative or founding their own organization?
Don't think much, otherwise it might dissuade you from starting. In all seriousness, I think the first thing you need to think of is, what difference can you make starting this enterprise organization up? Whether you can make a difference working elsewhere, or what will be the USP of this? Is it serving a region that is unserved? Is it performing a function that other organizations in the sector cannot perform? So something that is unique that adds value. And I think, more than anything, you'll build a team. You will eventually get the resources if you stick it out. Things will fall in place if you persevere. I think having good advisors in the beginning is very important. Some people who can guide you. Otherwise, it can you can feel lost. I sort of can only encourage people to look at starting their own thing, given that I've done the same thing. I think more than anything, you have to be satisfied. You have to enjoy the work, and you have to enjoy leading an organization, because then it becomes, fruitful.
How can our audience support you, Sohail, or your work moving forward?
just networking with us, reaching out to us. We would love to know more about your interests or your work. We'd be happy to keep you updated about ours. You can join our mailing list.
Well, my final question that I love to ask all of my amazing guests, that you gave me permission to invite you to answer in Hindi, as well as a little bit of English, is who or what inspires you?
So I'm going to do it in Hindi and then translate. Jin bachcho ke saath hum pro sport development mein kaam karte hain, wo mujhe prerna dete hain apna kaam aage badhane ke liye. So translation being, the kids that we work with, they are the inspiration that drives us to move forward with our work at Pro Sport Development.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Inspira podcast with Erica Mueller-Chen. I really hope you enjoyed the episode and found it useful. Be sure to check out the show notes for links and resources. Specifically, my link tree is there with tons of awesome information. Feel inspired to take action today? I've got 3 action steps you can take right now because you know your girl likes calls to action and the number 3. So here goes. Number 1, sign up for my mailing list by adding your email address. Number 2, check out my global resource hub and send it to someone in the sector who may be interested. Number 3, buy me a coffee. Or, if you know me, this will actually be a hot cocoa. Your support will help make sure this passion project prospers. All of these links are available by visiting my link tree. Until next time, stay inspired.